Welcome to another episode of the Photographer Mindset. I am your host, Aaron Manis.
And I'm your other co-host. Yeah, I'm your other co-host, Seth Macy. You're used to me doing the intros.
That's why you do it first. This is amateur hour over here.
I like to spring it on you sometime. This is the Photographer Mindset podcast, episode, 212?
Wow.
It's always fun talking to you weekly and talking to our guests weekly. And today we had on Canadian Ryan Wilkes. Incredible filmmaker, has a ton of credits under his belt that you can see just from being on his website. A ton of knowledge about filmmaking, and we talked a lot about, I guess, storytelling for people who are interested in video. We got to talk about the Ember Freefly, my friggin' fantasy camera that I've, how many times have I sent you clips about that?
Too many times.
Ryan has been shooting hummingbirds with that camera. It's a high speed camera. It's really cool to hear him talk about that. And he actually holds it up so you can see it. So another reason to subscribe to the YouTube page. But Ryan was a lot of fun to talk to. I learned a ton. I asked a ton of questions that, you know, I just genuinely had in general as someone who's interested in kind of migrating into the video world even more. So what did you think?
Yeah, some of those clips I'll throw on the YouTube video as well. Some of the hummingbird clips.
Yeah, please do.
Seth, send the helicopter one. That's a sick one with that camera and the camera's use. But talking to a professional is just very clear. When they're a professional and they've done it many times, many different ways, and they've worked on many different projects, they have a confidence about what they're doing and the information they're sharing. It was easy listen, and a ton of information.
Yeah, for sure. And if you like this episode, if you like what you're hearing, listen to these weekly episodes, please feel free to leave a rating and review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. It's a cost-free, effective way to support the show. Means a ton to us. Word from our sponsor, and then right into today's episode with Ryan Wilkes. Today's episode is sponsored by iStorage. They make high-quality, ultra-secure encrypted data storage devices and have been trusted by customers such as Warner Brothers, Rolls-Royce, and Disney. As a videographer, photographer, or content creator, you should value the security of your work just as much as the quality. Whether you're on a shoot, traveling, or collaborating with clients, iStorage provides a fortress for your creative assets, protecting your intellectual property and maintaining client confidentiality. As creatives, our projects are not just files. They're a culmination of all our hard work and artistic vision. Why leave them vulnerable to unauthorized access? I personally use multiple different devices made by iStorage because it gives me peace of mind knowing that my footage, images, and sensitive documents are safeguarded by military-grade encryption, ensuring that only I have access to my creations. Don't slack on your security. With iStorage's encrypted hard drives, you can focus on what you do best, which is creating amazing visual content. Visit the link in our episode description to explore their range of secure data storage solutions and fortify your creative workflow with confidence. Be sure to check out the discount code that's listed as well to save on your purchase at checkout. And now, on to today's episode. I was just on Vancouver Island, Ryan, and I was really upset when I got back home and realized there's wild peacocks in Victoria. Is this true?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you could call them wild, but there are peacocks and they do kind of freely roam, but kind of just in Beacon Hill Park, this one urban park. And yeah, but there's a ton there and they're fun.
How does
fun.
That happen? Somebody just let them loose one day? Are they native? Like, what's going on?
No, definitely not. You know that. Yeah. I think, you know, the story was, I think there was a hobby farm many years ago and they let them out and they just thrive here. Yeah. They kind of thrive anywhere. Like, I mean, there's like peacocks at the Calgary Zoo that just roam. Like they're not actually like a, in a enclosure at the zoo. They're just like there, like part of the scenery. They're wild.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Right. Well, Ryan, we appreciate your time today joining us. Thank you very much for coming on. Shout out to Dusty Cressy, who's been a guest twice on the show, who recommended you come on.
Thanks,
trying to make
Dusty.
A habit of asking guests when they come on who they would recommend. Just kind of build a little network there, and you know, endorsements mean a lot. You were a bioengineer. Yeah. What's up? Why aren't you doing that anymore?
Yeah. So back in the day, I was like an athlete and hard into academics, and that was just my wheelhouse, I guess. You know, okay. I was like playing hockey and rugby and track and then doing good in school. So it came time to choose what I was going to pursue, and looking around me at like the adults that I had as role models, I was like, everyone's in oil and gas. It's Calgary, right?
Fair enough.
I was like,
oil, gas, be an and beef.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, well, I guess I'm going to be an engineer. So I went to Edmonton for school, 4 years of materials engineering at school. Got out of that, worked for 2 years in the oil and gas industry back in Calgary. And that was enough time for me to realize this is not what I wanted to do the rest of my life. And so I'd always been interested in the medical field, but you know, when you're 17 and making big decisions, it's not, you know, the stuff's going to go wrong. You're just not going to nail it at that age. And so
I mean, 17-year-olds don't know what they want to do with their life. Is that what you're saying?
That's one of the great truths of life. Yeah. Don't make big decisions when you're 17.
That's when all the big decisions happen too.
I know. We need to change that. Anyways, yeah. I originally wanted to be a surgeon, but at 17, I was like, I want to do 10 years of school. But then after doing this engineering degree and being like, oh my God, this isn't for me, I ended up doing another 5 years of school anyways, doing my PhD in bioengineering. So I was kind of doing this multidisciplinary study, combining my knowledge about materials engineering and then learning more the medical side of it. So my research was developing biodegradable bone screws for bone fixation. So little metal
screws,
plates that can dissolve in your body after your bones finish healing.
Wow.
Yeah.
What did anything ever come of that? Is that a thing now?
The lab that I was working in is still doing the research. And so I'm actually kind of lost touch with them over the past couple of years. So I'm not sure how far they've gotten, but yeah, it's still ongoing. And, you know, it could make a difference in a lot of people's lives because so many of the titanium and stainless steel that gets put into folks, there's all these problems down the road. Like you got these huge clusters of bone that form on top of them. If you have to get it removed, the surgery is crazy, super invasive and stressful and expensive for the people and, you know, the healthcare system, if that exists in the country. So yeah, it has the potential to be a game changer.
Very, very cool. Yeah. All right. And then fast forwarding, how did you end up, you know, working on nature documentaries, filming with that incredible camera of yours that we're going to get to? I'm fighting all temptation to talk about it, but how did you get to where what you're doing now, man? I checked out your website, lots of cool credits, lots of great footage, aquatic life, Canadian photographer of the year from Canadian Geographic. Is that correct? 2022?
That's correct. Yeah.
Congratulations. That's an awesome great accolade. Mm-hmm.
Cheers.
Was that the snake out of the water?
Yeah.
That photo?
Yeah.
That photo was so cool.
Thank you. Yeah. One of my favorite.
Yeah.
So the process of getting to where I am now was pretty accidental, as I think it is for a lot of people. I moved to New Zealand in 2015 and I was all alone. I'd been to New Zealand before playing rugby, but like I was in a completely different part of the country. Didn't know anyone in the city I was living in, which is Christchurch. And you know, when you get away from all the influences that you grew up with, that, you know, and, you know, parents, friends, whatever it might be, all those outside influences are gone. It gives you so much time and space to think about what you actually want to do. And so I just started experimenting and I happened to have a Hero 4 GoPro at the time. And I was like, I'm just going to go film stuff. And, you know, this is the age, the golden age of Casey Neistat. So, of course, I started vlogging. And I was doing like hiking vlogs. And so every weekend, you know, I'd go out and make a vlog of me exploring New Zealand. And it just grew relatively quickly. So at the end of 2016, I like got my first gig, which was filming a music festival. It was unpaid, but it was like, oh my God, I get a media pass to go to this music festival. You know, it was pretty cool. I was like camping with all the festival goers and everything, but got a backstage pass and made a cool little edit. Never got used, but then I used that video pitch to a bigger festival in Christchurch. And that was my first ever paid gig. And from there, I just kind of started freelancing, doing, you know, all the regular freelancing stuff. restaurants, events, parties, live music. And then by the time I came to like 2019, so I'd been freelancing for about 2 years, maybe, I was like, I want to tell actual stories. And that's when me and a few friends from New Zealand went to East Africa. I made my first documentary, Fly the Roof, which was about a paragliding mission from the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. So it's like the world's biggest hike and fly. So, you know, 7 days up and 45 minutes down. So that was really cool. And then me and my creative partner there, Harry, we made another short conservation documentary in Kenya. And it was really that trip that was like, okay, this is what really fills my cup. And this is what I want to do.
Right. Can I interject in your story?
Absolutely.
So what was the name of your first documentary? Sorry, I missed it.
Fly the Roof.
Fly the Roof. So where do ideas like this come from? It's your first kind of idea for a film, for a short doc. For you, how are ideas born? And how do you know you have a good idea for a video, whether it's 30 seconds or an hour and a half?
Yeah.
This is all opinion, of course.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Everyone has different processes. For me, ideas come from curiosity often and just consuming media in different ways. Like maybe I'll be reading an article online and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. If someone made a film on that. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the first step. So whether I'm speaking with someone, whether I'm watching something on Netflix, reading an article, I'm always just like, my mind is always just being like, is there a story there? And then from that initial inception of like the general idea, then you dive into development or like, you know, really seeing like, okay, is there a story here? Who are the characters? What is the conflict? How much is this going to cost? All that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I use Notion to like organize my entire brain. And I have this one subset like list in Notion that is just all ideas, and there's like 30 ideas there for documentaries. Just
what's Notion?
It's like an amazing like kind of like Evernote, like a note-taking platform.
Okay.
Like a project manager, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I really enjoy using it for just brain dumping and keeping everything kind of out of here and onto paper so I don't forget. Right. And so I got all these ideas, but the scary part is actually diving into them and seeing if there could be something. And this is for longer form stuff, right? Like this is mm-hmm. for like when I actually want to make a film and have to, you know, make a budget and get funding. When it comes to shorter content, like the stuff I've been putting out lately on Instagram, that's really like experimentation for me. It's just a bit of fun. It's kind of like a bit of a game, really. It's like, okay, what do people like, and like what gets people's attention? And sometimes it's really surprising.
I was gonna say, it's very surprising. Sometimes you're like, this is not very intriguing, and then other people are like, what, this is amazing, or something you think is so incredible, people mm-hmm. like swipe.
So this is one of my biggest learnings from like going semi-viral lately on Instagram, is that we as creatives, photographers and videographers, for the most part, is my circle of people that I interact with most. We're in this like echo chamber. We're in this weird little bubble where such a high percentage of the people who follow us and interact with us do the same thing that we mm-hmm. do. And so they see something and they've probably seen it before because we're just in this space. But as soon as you can break through and get regular everyday people to see your stuff, the sky's the limit. And that's exactly what happened. Yeah. I like broke through the wall of just the same people seeing my stuff. And now just all these regular everyday folks who just think hummingbirds are the coolest thing ever, which like they
I'm
are.
I'm one of them, by the way, my hands up.
But did you do anything to change? Did you do anything to change or break through that wall where you're like, okay, I'm doing X, Y, and Z that just gets to my following or other photographers or content creators. I'm hitting a wall. I got to change something up. Do I need a hook? Do I need something different? What was the, can you pinpoint what broke through, or was it just a random occurrence?
It's a combination of a few things, I think, in my case. And the first thing was posting something that not a lot of people had ever seen before. So it was new. And that involved the Ember, that involved shooting hummingbirds at extremely high frame rates to get crazy slow motion. But then on top of that, it took a ton of consistency as well. And so for 8 weeks straight, I posted every day except for a Saturday. And that was about 8 to 10 posts a week. So some days I was doing 3 to 4 reels, 2 to 3 static posts, carousel photo posts. And for the first 2 weeks, nothing really happened. I had one, the very first slow motion clip I posted went like semi-viral, got out to like 400,000 people. And that, for me, that was insane. I was like, whoa. But then 2 weeks after that, nothing happened. It went so quiet, but I just kept consistent. And then is when the craziness happened over those kind of the last 5 weeks of that 8 week period. Yeah.
Interesting. So just consistency, staying with it, having a method and seeing it through.
The hook is also like extremely important. Like anyone who makes stuff for Instagram, it's like all about the first 3 seconds. Like, what are you promising? And being a little bit like extra about, in a way, you know, like what is the payoff going to be if someone sticks around for the next 7 seconds? And I really focus on that. I'm like, okay, what am I going to show them? And how do I word this carefully in very plain language so that they're going to want to see what I have to show them? Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember reading somewhere, I follow this account. I think it's Viral Video Club. I don't know if you've heard of this. I love this account. Yeah. And it's funny because I'm not someone who like is posting reels all the time. I'd like to, but sometimes other things are more pressing. But I think one of the things this person said was that fifth grade level verbiage or the way you word things has the most engagement statistically. I don't know how they measured that, but it just made me think of that when you said plain language that people can understand, whether it's like a caption or like photo text that comes up in the hook promising something. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, it's all like, and I've also found that in general, not all the time, but posting a few seconds of myself shot on a phone, smiling behind the camera, whatever it is, with the hook over those 3 seconds, those posts tend to do much better than just showing the thing right off the bat.
Right, right. I do want to return to that point you brought up because it's a really good one, that we're in kind of an echo chamber. And I think myself included at times, I've got caught up in, I want to make something that impresses my peers. Of course, I want to make something that I'm proud of first, but I also want to make something that impresses my peers, my other photographer and videographer and content creator friends. And I think, Aaron, you've brought this up before as well, that in terms of reaching new people, those aren't the people you're trying to serve with your content. You want everyday people who, when they see a 600 millimeter prime lens, they go, oh my God, what is that? Or when they see an Ember Free Fly, they're like, whoa. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, we get so used to thinking that a grizzly bear diving for salmon is normal because in our tight community, we see so, well, like how many frames are those people shooting in an hour? 10,000. Like there's so many, there's so much content in such a small pocket. Right.
Yeah.
So it's a great point.
And if you have time with a grizzly bear or a bald eagle or whatever it is, and you're efficient, you might have content for 3 months, like great content for 3 months of 8 second clips from that 2 hour session. It could go on forever. So it does become inundated now I think. And you see so many, I don't know what's with my algorithm, but I'm just seeing so many bald eagles and these amazing shots. Like it's just part of my algorithm. And that's what I've been shooting lately. And it's kind of disheartening. I got to like stay focused and be like, I'm doing this for me and I like it, but it's like, I don't want to post that photo because I just saw 400 that were like bald eagles in the person's face.
What I just shot's not that cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So you gotta like, that's part of it though, but that's part of like reaching. How can you get a hook? How can you see that one cool moment with the bald eagle, like taking, you know, chasing after a blue heron that's near the nest, like get something interesting so you can say, you won't believe what this bald eagle just did, showing yourself. And people are like, what'd it do? And then they show it's chasing a blue heron and they're like, oh, that was cool. Even if they don't think it was that cool, they stayed to just see, what did that bald eagle just do? And I think that is kind of the trick versus if you go right to the awesome video of a bald eagle, they're like, bald eagle, got it, next, within 2 seconds, you know? Yeah.
It's important to remind ourselves though, that the stuff that we consume on a daily basis in this niche is not normal.
No.
I think is the point of what Ryan was saying, right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So you may have noticed we just had to switch cameras. The A7 IV overheated. It got demoted and now Ryan's on the FX3. So it's all good. We went to the upgrade. We made the joke that this camera we've been alluding to, this Freefly Ember, should have recorded the rest of the podcast. But you figure it'd be how many terabytes of footage if we did the rest of the podcast on that bad boy?
I think like an hour would be about 4 terabytes.
That's half my big drive. That's insane. That's insane. Okay, well, you have the Freefly Ember. Hold it up for everybody to see. Very cool. It's a Sony mount, correct?
Yeah, it is an E-mount. However, it's a dumb E-mount. So there's no electronic contacts. And so any Sony ass like with any that needs electronics to work, you can't use on this. Not even manual focus, because it needs the camera and even to do the manual focus. So only lenses.
Wow. Okay, so you're holding up the Freefly Ember.
Yeah.
Explain to people listening who aren't watching on YouTube. Well, explain to people on YouTube, but there's a lot of people who are just listening. Explain to them. They have no idea what this Freefly Ember camera is, what it does, why you purchased it, etc.
So the Freefly Ember is what we call a high-speed camera. So basically, it shoots slow motion at crazy frame rates. So this camera has a 5K Super 35 sensor and can shoot 5K and up to 600 frames per second, full 4K in 800. And then you can go to like a letterbox, 2.37 to 1, and do 1,000 frames per second.
Wow.
So
have you gotten it up to 1,000 before?
I have, yeah.
Wow.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
See, I would be running around everything. I would make it 2 feet and I would want to film something.
Like dropping marbles into water days straight.
Exactly. But I bet you it's way more difficult than you think, because I bet you some things just aren't fast enough.
Exactly. So this is my like dilemma with this camera. I bought this for a very specific reason, which is to film hummingbirds for the film that I'm currently making. But I'm like, okay, this camera's a ton of fun and like birds in general are really sweet, but even like you shoot like an eagle, you shoot a bald eagle at 600 frames per second and it gets kind of boring unless it's doing something epic, but if it's just flying, like,
we're really hating on eagles today. Bald eagles. They're getting they have a bad day.
Yeah.
And they're bald. They don't have hair.
It's a very specialized tool, and while it is amazing and the footage that comes out of it is great, it's not for everything. And you know, I think, you know, a lot of people say they would kill for this camera, but
I'm a hand up for people listening on
actually Apple. Using it, because it's an extra thing. Like, you know, I have a whole extra case with everything I need to operate this.
Right.
On top of my FX3 and my A7IV and another bag. And so it's a ton of kit to be lugging around.
Yeah. Is it heavy?
No, it's not super heavy.
But you need all the lenses, you said, too?
Yeah, exactly. So the lenses is tricky, because
as I said, this has a dumb E mount. And so everything is adapted for the most part, except for a couple like Laowa lenses that I have that are E mount that are just fully manual anyways. But my main long lens for wildlife is like a 35-year-old Nikon 400 f3.5 prime. And Nikon is, I mean, I'm so thankful they exist right now. I'm like not a Nikon fanboy or anything, but like they're the camera manufacturer that kept, of like the big three, that kept fully manual control on their lenses the longest. So like, if it wasn't for them, like I'd have to go back to like Canon FDs to get a long lens, like 400 mil or bigger, that had aperture control on it, on the lens, because there's no, yeah, I can't control any aperture.
Oh, right, right, right.
And so it was tricky. And I did weeks of research on lenses, as you can imagine, to figure out what's going to give me the best bang for the buck, because 400 millimeter primes are extremely expensive. And so I could have gone with a more modern Nikon lens because they kept those aperture ring on the lens for a really long time. But going from that 400 f3.5 to a 400 f2.8 was like a $5,000 price increase.
Yeah.
It was wild. More than now, is that,
that's a Nikon mount, or I thought you said a Sony mount.
It is a Sony. So I adapt the Nikon lens to the mount.
Oh,
wow.
So there's an adapter between mounts. Is it like an F mount to an E mount?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that even existed.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's very cool. The first clip I ever saw shot on the Freefly Ember was, I think it was a Coast Guard helicopter. I don't know if you've seen the clip.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Oh my God. I'll have to put it in our story. You can see the vortex from the blades. And I thought it was AI, CGI, whatever I. And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, I was so mesmerized by that thing. But I can see what you're saying, where there's probably a very small amount of high speed things that you could use this for. And that leads into a question of mine. Well, several questions, and I'll refrain from doing what I usually do where I rifle all three or four off at once.
Yeah.
But I'll start with the general one since we're on the topic of gear. In your opinion, what does gear do for you? What does upgrading really do for you? You mentioned that in this case, you wanted it for a specific project. Is that often the reason you get gear personally?
Yeah, I only buy gear if I have a specific use, if I have a need. Like,
right.
You know, I do the same thing as a lot of us probably do, which is fantasize over gear, look at prices all the time, see if, like, check marketplace, like, oh, maybe there's a deal and, like, I can just justify getting what I want. But, like, especially with a purchase like this, you know, we're talking about for the body alone, $25,000 Canadian, $18,000 US. Like that is huge. That's the most I've ever spent on anything in my entire life. But at a very specific use, and I had, like, I was married to this creative vision for this film that I had in my mind, and I knew I needed a high speed camera. Now, when you look at the high speed camera market, you're either getting like a Kronos, or which like haven't been very good, a Freefly Wave, which is Freefly's first high-speed camera they released a few years ago. Only shoots 1080. Dynamic range is abysmal. And then you're going up to the Phantom. And, you know, Phantoms are a whole nother level. Like, you need a ton of training to use it. You need... Often when you hire Phantom, you're getting an operator as well. You can't just rent a Phantom and use it on your shoot. And you're looking at well over 50K for a Phantom.
Wow.
And so this was like in the range where it was like everything is solid enough. The sensor is great. The dynamic range isn't as good as like my FX3, for example, which is such an amazing camera. But it's good enough that if I'm careful and I light things properly and choose my shots, it can create amazing results. And I'll probably sell it, honestly, at the end of the year when I'm done this project. And I've done a couple extra shoots for myself where I'm like, I really need a high-speed shot of that for the portfolio. I'll probably, you know, sell it off and try to make my money back. Yeah.
You don't think people have to pry it from your hands to be able to do that?
Well, I've, you know, I would love to keep, because it's just a great thing to have. And, you know, I was shooting so much wildlife and working on bigger wildlife productions now, being able to offer this and rent it out as part of my kit is, you know, a pretty cool prospect. So,
right. We'll see.
Yeah.
One of my other, so I guess in your mind, you're envisioning, I'm not really paying $25,000 for this. I'm paying what I'm paying minus my resale value. And that's worth what I need it for this project.
Well,
does it ever,
this project is also funded. And so
that was my next point. I'm going to make, this is going to make me money, or it's funded, or it's not necessarily all out of my account. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. So like a decent percentage of this camera is already being paid off by the project I'm working on, because I'm renting the camera from my production company to that production.
So it's a budget. And this is so important for people to hear, I think, when they see, when they hear about insane gear, like Canon's 50 to 1000 millimeter lens. Have you seen that?
I've shot on it a few times.
Yeah, you shot on it too?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my buddy Slater, who's been on the show a few times, is going to love hearing about this. What was your experience with it?
50 to 1000.
It's amazing. Yeah,
Bertie Gregory shoots a lot of his stuff on it.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's the gold standard in wildlife.
Yeah.
So you have a Red Raptor and the Canon CN20, and that's the ticket to getting the shots that no other lens can get, really.
Yeah, this is what you're seeing in like Frozen Planets and Blue Planets and stuff like that, and they're all rigged up to gimbal systems.
And it's got a 1.5 teleconverter that not a lot of people talk. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how you're getting like polar bears, just the eye in 8 million K.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's incredible. Yeah. Cause I had written down, I mean, I guess we've already answered, unless you want to weigh in a bit more, at what point do you know, hey, I really need this piece of gear for my kit? I think maybe you answered like, it's serving a clear artistic vision that makes sense financially as well. Either with a budget, or maybe you're just like super rich, right?
I mean, I think you just summed it up very well. It's like, do I have a creative vision that can only be executed by having this piece of kit? And does it make financial sense? You don't want to put yourself in the hole for a piece of kit on a project that's not going to make you money. So knowing that you already have part of that paid off through whatever project you're working on, and also knowing that it's going to satisfy you internally because it's going to allow you to create what you envision, I think that's you. But then also, you know, I didn't just have to buy this.
Right.
Monitor, V-mounts, lenses, like, as you know, tripods are like the most expensive thing in the world when you get into fluid heads, and just, you need a solid fluid head for wildlife. So,
And you're really probably, you're weighing your tripod down, right? The heavier the better. I know a lot of people with that motto, just for the micro shakes.
Mm-hmm. Occasionally, I mean, it depends on how heavy of a head you're using. Oftentimes, the camera will be heavy enough to provide enough weight.
Right.
And when you have a solid fluid head, like, it's just butter. You know, you're not getting those shakes because the counterbalance and everything is just perfect, really. Yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah. Well, speaking of gear, do you think people get way too hung up on gear?
I think some people do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, like...
I'll never be a filmmaker unless I have a Red camera, for example. Oh, I heard that one before. What's your opinion on that?
I think it's garbage because, you know, I have like award-winning images that have been published from my GH5 and my Panasonic G9. Like, I only switched over to full frame in the last 2 years. For the first 6 years of playing with cameras, I was on Micro Four Thirds. And still some of my favorite images that I'll probably ever make were shot on those cameras. And, you know, I still have my trusty GH5 because, like, can't give it up, too attached to it. And it's just so reliable. But anyways, yeah, I totally think that everyone gets way too hung up on the gear. Like, I went through this not too long ago. Like, before I was buying the A7IV, I was like, okay, I need a stills cam that can, like, be a B cam or a C cam. So shoots decent video too. And I'm like, oh my God, A7 R5, 60 megapixels. Like,
how what Aaron shoots with. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I was like, the A7 IV is just an amazing camera. gets mm-hmm. you 90% of the way to what the A7R5 is and arguably is better for video. And so, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to save myself the 1500, $2,000 and just go with the A7IV. But little decisions like that are coming up all the time for all of us, I think. And
right.
I think like you shouldn't upgrade until you push your gear to the limit. And that's what
yeah.
I always.
Yeah. I've said that too. How do you know when you hit the limit?
When just it overheats.
When it overheats and you got to re-record.
That's yeah. why you need the A7R5.
So Aaron zinged you back because you made him have buyer's remorse on his A7R5.
Great video until it overheats 8 minutes in. Really useful.
I'm proud of you, Aaron. You got your zinger in. Good for you.
Well done.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of a topic I've struggled with too for my next camera. And maybe you can help me out because I've said it before on this podcast, but I'll re-say it here. Photos are fun. I'm always going to take photos, but I feel like I need something to be a beginner at again and kind of learn and advance through. And that's for me, video. And I've been kind of torn between, do I get a really good hybrid camera like A7R5 or something like that? Or do I bite, if I had to pick one or the other, or do I bite the bullet on something like an FX3? And if I'm feeling this way, I'm sure there's a lot of other people listening. So what would you recommend in that instance?
Well, I think especially in your case, Seth, the A7 or the FX3 is just like such a good option. And the main reason is for that 12,800 second base ISO.
Yeah.
Like the number of times that saves me, like literally on every shoot where I'm like, if I was on any other camera right now, I couldn't be shooting because I'm on a long lens. I'm at like F9. Sun's going down.
Yeah.
How am I going to expose this properly? Just go to 12,800 and it saves me so much. Gives me that extra half hour of shooting when you really need it, you know, when yeah. active thing, when stuff's going down and it's clean, it's nice. Yeah.
Is that the base, the 12?
It resets. And this is what I'm about to ask him. Do you know how that works from a technical standpoint? Everyone that I've talked to just knows that it resets at 12,800. You go back to base ISO, but, and you get a clean shot. That's but weird. I don't have yet to have anyone explain it to me like a fifth grader to return to that concept. And I was wondering if you're able to or not. If you're not, don't worry, join the club.
So we got 800 and we got 3,200. Like 3,200 is for my camera, the
native ISO.
Yeah. Native ISO. Yeah. So 32 times 4, isn't that 12,800? So it must be like a math thing where the pixels or the noise or whatever is the clearest. Yeah.
That's a good question.
Should we ask AI while you guys talk?
You need to get Gerald Undone on here, man.
Because what's that? 8 times 4 is 3,200. 3,200 times 4 is 12,800.
Yeah.
So there's something to do with, like, it's got to be the evenness of the math or the double up, quadruple but up.
What is interesting is actually the noise level at 12,800 is not as clean as it is at 800. It's about the same level as it is at 3,200. And so what I will do when I shoot is, like, I'm not afraid to go to 3,200, but if I'm going above 32, I just go to 12,800 and stomp down to get my exposure right, because it won't be as clean at 4,000
right.
as is at 12,800. Yeah.
Weird.
So if someone wanted to get their first cinema camera, and again, this is just opinion, this is not gospel, and they were torn between something like an FX3 or an FX30, what direction would you steer them in? Asking for a friend.
Are they just gear videographers, or are they wanting to take some photos as well?
I think that's a key question.
Yeah. Yep.
And Seth, you do, because some of your livelihood is my this photo is packages. True,
but I mean, I have backup cameras.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? Also. Mm-hmm. And I just like... I kind of want to burn the boats a bit, right? Like,
yeah,
I want to be going into the field or whatever. Like, hey, you're filming. You know, there's no, You're not necessarily doing, like, you don't have, I don't want to say the easy route of taking stills, because that's not fair, but what you're already familiar with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. I think that's a better way to put it. And I've been looking at both. I don't want to overspend on something, but I don't want to have to upgrade a year from now. That old debate.
Totally. That's very valid. I mean,
you know?
So one thing that I would say is that the FX3 still has a mechanical shutter, which is very handy for photography. And although it's only a 12 megapixel sensor, the photos that come out of it are pretty sweet. And that second dual base ISO does play a role in photography as well. So, you know, you need to get your shutter speed up. It's getting dark. You can still crank to 12,800 ISO for photos and get clean images. Obviously, you know, you throw it into Topaz or Lightroom After and clean it up more. Mm-hmm. But that has also, I've produced some images that I'm really happy with on my FX3. Whereas the FX30 does not have a mechanical shutter. It's electronic only. And the readout speed isn't that fast. And so you will get blurring in your image on a regular basis. From taking photos on, even though it's a higher megapixel count. I think it's like, this is like 20 or 23 megapixels, something around there.
It is higher. I thought it was 20. Yeah. I could be wrong.
But in practice, it doesn't make as much sense to me as the FX3.
Okay.
So that's the difference in photos between them. But now tell me, I have the A7R 5. What's the difference video-wise between the FX3 and the A7R 5?
Well,
I'm not quizzing you. If you know, great.
This has turned into, have you studied?
Yeah.
He's back in school.
Do you work at PhD Sony?
In Photography Minds Podcast.
Doctor?
I can tell you what I know, which isn't the whole, but obviously the A7R 5 can shoot 8K. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. In 24,
but it's 420. It's not 422 10-bit, right?
It's only right. I believe so.
The FX3, I guess the biggest thing for the FX3 is shooting 4K 60 and 4K 120.
Mm-hmm.
120, there's a slight crop. It's like 1.1 or something like that. Like, you can notice a little bit tight. If you're shooting wildlife, that doesn't matter at all. We're always wanting to get tighter.
Mm-hmm.
But nearly full frame 4K 60 and 4K 120, 10-bit.
That's true.
Also, the audio handle, like if you're doing documentaries, like the fact you can have four channels in to the FX3 is huge.
That's a big one. Yep.
I mean, the fan is great. Mm-hmm. Doesn't eat. Should have started with this, not this. Couldn't have had that little hiccup.
So good.
Yeah.
All right. So good.
Cool. I'm sold.
Right. Let's move on from gear a bit. Let's get back to just the art of filmmaking. In your opinion, and maybe this pertains to, you know, I find it hard to believe that you got everything right as you were improving your skills as a filmmaker. What are some things maybe you got wrong in the beginning or throughout the process, even now? And you know, what are some things you see maybe other people who are starting out in filmmaking getting wrong? Simple things. Maybe wrong is the wrong word, but maybe they're moving in a less efficient way than they could be.
Yeah. I think one thing that's really underrated is like data management from the outset. So
fair.
Like I did a story the other day that a lot of people appreciate. I was like, this is how I now do my data management. This is what I do. I come home from a shoot, where everything goes, how I log it. And so basically what I do is come home, all the cards go on the left side of my laptop. And this is kind of like my just...
Mm-hmm.
Brain in the physical space being like, okay, everything on the left side has not been dumped. Everything on the right has been. If I have cards in the field that get full, I take them out of my pack or out of the camera and I put a little piece of red gaff tape on them and the camera and the card number, 1, 2, 3. And so I just know they're hot cards, you know, they've got important stuff on them. I come home, then goes on to my like big array and just like date everything. And the date is the most important thing. I can't believe how many people do not put dates on their folders. Because for me, that is the way that I can go back and really find footage easily. If someone comes to me, they're like, hey, do you have any clips of sea lion? Do you have any clips of this? I can like, in my mind, be like, oh, I shot sea lions at the herring spawn. I go into my Google Calendar on my phone. I see, oh, you're at the herring spawn these 2 days. Then I can just go on my drives and I know the exact date and the folder that I'm looking for.
Right.
If I'm working on a specific project, like the hummingbird project I'm working on now, I actually have an Excel spreadsheet that is like a daily log. And so what that serves as is just a quick dump at the end of the day of what was shot on the day. If there's any key shots, the location. And I also put the location like in my folder structure as well, just so it's super easy to find. Yeah. But organization is so key, because what happens is 3 years down the line, you're looking at a stack of 10, 20 drives, and you never want to go into them because it's daunting. You don't know what's on them. You don't know where to begin. So just start early. Just like figure out a system that works for you there. Because
right, it's a problem that can snowball.
Yeah.
We've all deleted stuff on a hot card. It's happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I just recently did, and it was a painful moment. I went like this. So I'm going to play it out. I went, oh, okay. For a long time, I just happened to be driving, and there's a blue heron about 20 feet from me, and it didn't take off because I'm in my car, and I had my camera videoing it in 120 HD, full, like 600, really in, and it dove down and bit a fish, like got a fish, came up, shook it, and gulped it all in frame. And I just sat on that for a while. And then I had to do something, and I formatted quick, and I went, fuck. Fuck.
Oh,
I just did that and I went, okay. Well, there's other
blue herons. And you feel so dumb after, too. I've done it, too. You're like, why?
What? Yeah.
What are you doing? It's just working too fast. And this is to Ryan's point. I mean, if you have preventative measures, it's never going to happen. You can never goof up like that, right?
Yep.
Always have the colored tape in the bag, because it just
like... Yeah, good call.
Yeah.
That is a good tip.
Anything else?
What else in those early days?
It's fine to say no.
You don't know.
What about like storytelling? Like,
sure.
I feel that one can get lost in the weeds. Thousands of B-rolls are like, this is something that throws you from the video.
Thinking about structure while you're filming too.
Yeah. Video is interesting because things can throw you. Music choices, a bad sound effect that you put in at the wrong time, you know, or just like incongruent B-rolls just trying to fill space.
Or something cool happens when you're out and you get sidetracked from your original mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's laughing because like, how many times does that happen? Probably a lot, right? And you're just where am I?
When you're like, you know, when you're a professional, that can't happen. Like, you know what I feel like that never happens anymore. But yeah, that used to happen sometimes. And I think like something that was going through my mind as you were saying that, Aaron, is like overshooting and not going out with a plan. And it's totally fine to not go out with a plan if you're just going out for fun. But like, if you're going out for a purpose, you really need to think about every shot and how it's going to move the story forward. If you're trying to tell a story, if you're just creating beautiful images, like that's one thing. But crafting a story and crafting a documentary film, it's like so cutthroat. Like you're always cutting stuff where you're like, this looks so good, but like it doesn't serve. It's not answering the question that this film has set out to tell. And so if you're a shooter, it's really important, in my opinion, to have some editing experience so that you can put yourself in the shoes of the editor. Or you work very closely with an editor, you know, at the higher levels, no cinematographer is editing their own stuff. But at like our levels and people who are starting out, I think it's super valuable to think like an editor so that you can pick off like those little shots that you know you need for coverage, for B-roll, to hide cuts, that kind of thing. But like not going out and just like spraying and praying. you know?
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
No, that's totally fair.
Good advice.
How do you know you're overshooting? Is it as simple as veering from your shot list?
No, because I think that's important. I think you need to be able to veer from the shot list and pick up stuff. And so much of being a documentary storyteller is following the story. If you're presented with new information you didn't have before the shoot started, then like maybe you have to follow that and go there. And maybe there's going to be a ton of extra footage that's not going to get used, but at least you have it. And so this is always a battle in my mind. It's like, should I shoot this right now? And 9 times out of 10, I just shoot it because I'd way rather have it. I'm there. Like the money spent to be there has been spent in order for you to be there, for the production to be going on. I'd rather have it so that I can decide in the edit rather than like have that regret or like having to go do a pickup shoot and having it be like forced and not natural as it would have been in the moment.
Do you have a direct example that comes to mind as you're telling us that? Where you're like, I should click record.
Okay, well, one example that happened very recently that actually like saved myself by putting, you know, like a safety in place. But I'm doing this hummingbird documentary and the bird that's like the main character in the story or like the main supporting character, her chick was going to fledge very soon. And so on the day that I thought the bird was going to fledge, I hired a second camera. I hired a sound recordist and we went there and we're setting up. And I'm like, that bird seems pretty active today. Like, I think it's going to leave the nest like pretty soon. So I just went and put my GH5 on the nest and just left it there rolling with like a huge cart so it can roll for 10 hours. 15 minutes after that, before I had the ember set up, before I had anything set up, the bird took off. And so like, I was just like, oh my God, like kind of mad at myself that I wasn't there a little earlier, just rolling and just being there, just capturing the moment, but so happy that I had the wherewithal to just be like, let's just put this camera up right now, done, and there's a shot. So yeah. I kind of saved myself, but I'm also like, oh my God, like.
Well, you'd be a lot more mad if you didn't
take
that.
Yeah.
That's a good story. Yeah. Because who knows when that's going to happen again, right?
Oh, I mean, never, because that bird.
Birds are like this tall, this big.
Yeah.
I've been telling that bird for 6 weeks, so it's like the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, yeah, thanks.
It's true. And that reminds me of just like littler moments that I fight with out in the field where you want to look the back of the camera and, oh, did I just get a good photo? And then something sick happens right in front of you versus like staying in the moment. Like those pictures are there. You can look later versus like scrolling through and checking it out. I've done that way too many times where like shame on me, but it is just something you have to fight to just be in the moment. Be where you're supposed to be, do what you got to do so you don't miss things. You might miss the exact shot, but you're not going to miss the bulk of things and you can always check things later. So
I think we're talking about how a lot of little small actions separate professionals from amateurs, and that's okay. It's okay to be an amateur, right? But if you're really interested, you gain that knowledge, right?
Right.
You become an intermediate and then you become an advanced professional.
And it burns you so many times where you're like, all right, no more.
No not more, and I know again. I have it, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
When's your hummingbird documentary supposed to come out? I know these things take time.
It's up in the air right now, but I'm aiming for festival release.
Okay.
So I'm, you know, the fall of this year seems like a pretty good time. I'm editing it right now and it's feeling pretty good. So but you know, post is such a long process as well. Yeah. To go through so many different hands, has to go through color and sound mixing, have to work with the composer to get the music right and
cool
all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
When I was on your site, there was lots of credits, obviously, for all the things you've worked on. You know, not necessarily documentaries that were yours, but you know, other ones you've worked on. lots of different credits. And my question was, how many photos or videos do you think should live on a website to showcase, hey, I know what I'm doing, but to also not overwhelm viewers or people who potentially want to hire you? Like, I noticed on your video section, you have, I think, one video, right, on your website, but you're very experienced.
Yeah. I mean, I struggle with this all the time. I always want to share like
everything
as much as I can. Yeah, exactly. But that's not the best approach. And so I decided to kind of boil it down and share my best commercial work. So you're probably on my commercial page. It's like,
yeah, I think so.
From Brazil, where I'm like, okay, this is my most recent and like my favorite work to date, because I like to take on a couple like travel commercial gigs a year. It's super fun. And that's kind of how I got my start in it. And then like to focus on the documentary stuff. So that's like why I have that credits page, because when a producer comes looking for a cinematographer, they want to know what you've worked on. And so that's what that's for. And I battle with it all the time, but like, I think my website needs a bit of a revamp, in my opinion. I would like to cut back what I'm sharing in my portfolio pages, but then have like specific project pages so people can break out into those different pages to see what I shot. Yeah. Specific projects with like a bit of a description and all that kind of stuff, rather than having like a big long portfolio page. Right. Yeah.
Just something that's diverse, right?
Yeah.
What's your advice for people who are like, oh my, yeah, I'm enthusiastic listening to this episode. I really want to start filming stuff more than just maybe Instagram reels or TikToks. You know, what would you say to them to get started? Is it as simple as just go out and start shooting? You know, what's your strategy in this regard when starting something new like this? What would your advice be?
Are we talking about documentaries in particular?
I don't know. Let's make it super ambiguous and say, I just want to film something really cool that tells a story that makes sense, and I'm a total beginner. I think we covered a lot, like storyboard, have your shots in mind, have organized files. Is there anything more, do you think, to that? Or is it just as simple as having that knowledge, being patient with yourself, and just getting out and getting after it?
My approach has really been get out and get after it. Mm-hmm. Like, my approach has just really been fail fast and learn fast, you know, just kind of go out with this fearless attitude, a little bit, I don't want to say negligent, but just like, just going out and making stuff regardless of the roadblocks that might be there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those first two short docs that I made in East Africa, completely self-funded, basically. And they like did festival circuits and some of them, and like they won a couple awards here and there. And it was just like really learning all the time. Like, it's just like, okay, what's the structure of a story? And just like, having that up, like printed out, like on the whiteboard. It's like, okay, first act, conflict, resolution, second act, conflict, resolution. Like, you know, just really trying to take notes from people more experienced than me on what makes a good story. But also like just trying to like do it yourself, I think is so valuable. At least like that's how I learn. Mm-hmm. If people are really interested in documentaries, like there's some really great courses out there and communities out there now. Like, you know, Mark Bone has The Art of Documentary, which is a fantastic course, and the community is amazing. And all of a sudden you're surrounded all of these people who have similar goals as you and are trying to tell stories.
That's important. That's important. Surrounding yourself and putting yourself in that environment.
Yeah. If you're alone, like the collaborative aspect of this job is arguably my favorite part. And everything is just so much better when you have a creative partner and you're able to bounce ideas off of each other and also have your own ideas challenged. Because I think that's something that's tricky. It's like, if you're the only one looking at your work and you're too close to that story or work, whatever it is, you need to have someone with a different background, a different set of experiences, look at your work to be able to show you a different side and maybe tell you what you're not seeing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's very similar in writing, right? Like the writer knows the topic better than maybe anyone. So it's very easy to leave out small details that the audience might not know just because you already know it. It's like common sense to you. So I think viewing it as it's someone watching this for the first time or looking at hummingbirds for the first time is kind of an important lens to at least be able to approach and look through to make sure that you are telling the story for everyone, not just yourself.
Yes.
So I think that's important. I think exercise is important in anything in terms of like practicing. Ask ChatGPT, what should I film today? You know, like give me an idea and then go do it.
Yeah.
One thing I like doing in the beginning of my film days, not my film days, but like getting into it was go tell a story that is a 1 minute video and go tell the same story in a 10 minute video. And I think that's a really good exercise too. Like, what would you change to make this same story? There's not a ton added, but how do you drag it out? Which one looks better? Which one flows better? And you find like a lot of tricks in both, trying to get a point fast and draw out a point. So I think just like little practice things, like practicing, don't wait for the gig to practice. That's exactly. What I can say. Like, don't wait for the gig to figure it out. That's not great.
I think one thing that helped me a lot was like, I think I made 120 vlogs while I was in New Zealand and traveling. Yeah. So like, Matt, that repetition.
Yeah, of course.
Amazing.
One of my favorite sayings, repetition is the mother of skill.
Mm-hmm.
People think about how long until I'm successful or until I get this. And I think the better way to look at it is how many reps until I get this. You know what I mean?
Totally.
I think that's a much better way of looking at it. And to your point too, we had a guy on Jad Davenport who said, just create your own assignments. Don't wait for an assignment. Do you want to go film red breasted lizards in I'm making that up and wherever, just go do it. You know what I mean? Maybe it's never been done before. Maybe that's what gets you your film festival circuit, right? And that sounds mm-hmm. it sounds like it pertains to exactly what you did, which is pretty cool. And hearing you do 120 vlogs, of course you're going to get better.
Yeah.
You're going to get better every single time. It's just reps, man. It really is.
It's absolutely just reps. And another thing that I think is really important is finding mentorship. And that can come in different ways. It doesn't have to be like the traditional definition of a mentor, like someone who you meet with and speak with. Like, you can have mentors who you just consume their content and read their and listen to them. But the more time you spend with that person's voice in your mind, the more you will pick up their habits, try the things they do, think like them. And so if there's someone whose work you really like and they do have like an online presence, I would say go seek that out. And maybe, who knows, maybe they are willing to take you on and to have you like come ace for them or whatever it might be. Don't be afraid to ask, because you never know. Like, a couple of people have reached out to me in the past little while to ask to go for coffee, to ask for advice, like, pretty new in the business, and I'm down. I will take an hour to go for coffee with these people because I know how important that is and how much of a game changer that can be for someone who is just starting out. Yeah,
very well said. And that's a great point about a mentor doesn't have to be someone you can text or call on the phone. I mean, I have mentors that are other podcasters, that are other YouTubers. Mm-hmm. That are authors. I mean, one of the things, you know, I say on this podcast all the time, read books 10 to 15 times because you become it. Like, it's to what you just said. It becomes more than, oh, I'm theorizing and reading this thing. You naturally start to, the book sinks into you, or the podcast sinks into you, or that you become, and it's to that age old thing, you become who you surround yourself with, whether that's digitally or in the physical flesh, right? So, To wrap up, maybe what's one piece of advice you would give yourself earlier on in your career, in life, about life, about anything?
Well, one piece of advice that I would give to young folks in general, not just like photographers, videographers, artists, but to young people in general, is like, move away from everything you grew up with. Be alone for a little while, and naturally you'll start to gravitate towards things that catch your interest and that can become something real in your life. Mm-hmm. And I never went to New Zealand to do my PhD thinking I was going to become a filmmaker, but you know, it happened, and it was all because I had all this time and space to explore different things and to try new hobbies and to see like what I was actually interested in my mid-20s. And so I think that's like a super valuable life experience that you can give yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Well said.
Excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, Ryan Wilkes, thanks so much for joining us today, buddy.
Thanks, guys. Been fun.
We appreciate it. Till next time.